excluded. I finally landed on the ability to produce sarcasm, which was far more useful. "Well, thanks for telling me," I said, rolling my eyes. "I've faked eating hummus all night for nothing." Jolene squeezed my shoulder. Ouch. She had some very strong hands. "I wasn't lying when I said my family's anti-vampire, but it's because they're werewolves, not rednecks. Actually, they're a little bit of both. I came to the FOTU meetings to try to get a better grip on how to deal with Tessie's being a vampire. I wanted to stay friends with her, and I knew my family, my clan, wouldn't be happy about it. And after she died, the group members were the only people I knew who were nice about it, who could understand why I was so upset. So I kept coming because I wanted to help other people who were going through the same thing. And then I met Zeb, and I'm in love with your friend," Jolene blurted out. "I know y'all have been close forever, and I want us to get along. I really do." "Okay," I said, at a loss to drum up any other response. "You're not upset?" Zeb asked, sounding suspicious. "Why would I be upset?" I asked. "I mean, I haven't had much time to process the information, but it's not as if Jolene can help being what she is any more than I can help being a vampire. In fact, you were born this way, right? You had even less of a choice than I did. It would be hypocritical of me to go all crazy just because my friend is dating a werewolf," Jolene said for me. "Right." Of course, that probably wouldn't keep me from going all crazy later, but I had to give myself some credit for being able to string that many words together through the shock. "I'm so glad you feel that way," Jolene squealed, throwing her arms around me. "We're going to be really good friends. I can just tell." As Jolene gave me a neck-cracking hug, I narrowed my eyes at Zeb, who smiled and shrugged. Great. My best friend was dating a werewolf who also happened to be a hugger. Chapter 13. Vampirism can lead to a wealth of new and exciting career opportunities, including overnight delivery driver, stunt person, and custom perfume blender. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. I may be the only person in history to have a telemarketing career lasting a total of 3 hours. Apparently, vampire powers do not translate to phone sales. I'd reviewed the promotional materials on Greenfield Studios. Despite its claims that the company brought quality family photography to the people without the high overhead or high-pressure sales tactics of in-store studios, I was just as uncomfortable with the prospect of shilling for them. But I'd filled out an application and given my word. And if my Anglo-Saxon Protestant heritage had blessed me with anything, it was a profound guilt-based work ethic. Since I wasn't going to be seen by the public, I abstained from my Gal Friday look and wore jeans and my lucky blue sweater. Lucky in that it was my one sweater that had never been stained. Now sporting a lemon-yellow tracksuit, Sandy met me at the front entrance and led me through the lobby to a shiny pine door. It was a lot like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, only instead of a magical room where everything is made of chocolate, I got a back room filled with headset-wearing chain smokers. The clamor of desperately pleasant conversation was deafening. The room was as dingy and chaotic as the lobby had been spotless. Green contest entry slips exploded out from inboxes in each cubicle. Poster-sized performance charts were layered on top of each other on the wall, listing who'd made sales that night and who hadn't. The stained floor was littered with old entry slips, crumbs, and cigarette butts. And casting an evil eye over it all was a banner that read in huge red letters, "If you don't sell, you go home." Inspiring.
"Greenfield Studios is a national operation with call centers across the country," Sandy chirped. "Half Moon Hollow is our latest branch to open. Our field representatives pass out these entry slips at community events, school fairs, fundraisers, and if people are interested, they fill out their personal information. The slip clearly states that even if they don't win the cruise, we reserve the right to contact them for future promotions."
Sandy handed me a neon green slip that screamed, "Win a cruise for two to the Bahamas from Greenfield Studios," where some poor sap named Aaron Miller had traded his phone number and an evening's worth of peace for a shot at a vacation.
"Each shift, you receive 75 slips. You call the numbers, remind the customers that they willingly gave us their entry information, and let them know that our traveling studio is coming to their hometown."
"Traveling studio?" I said, my heart sinking just a degree further.
Yes, our photographers travel to mid-price hotels, where they set up a portrait studio in a conference room or suite and take family pictures by appointment. Your job is to arrange the appointments and persuade the customers to pre-order one of these.
Sandy rifled through a pile of papers on a nearby desk and found what looked like a normal wall clock until she turned it so that I saw the face. Some poor family with stiff, uncomfortable smiles was frozen in time there, forever pinned beneath a minute hand that seemed to be sprouting from the mother's chest like a grotesquely ornate spear. Wow. At least I knew what the exciting new product was. The scariest freaking clock I had ever seen.
It's a beauty, isn't it?
Sandy sighed.
Every year, the company comes up with a new promotional item. Last year, it was throw pillows with the family photo silk-screened on. This year, it's kitchen clocks. You're paid minimum wage, plus a $2 commission per appointment booked. You book an average of 3 appointments in an hour, or you will be sent home. If less than 50% of your bookings follow through with their appointments, your commission will be reduced. You pay for use of your headset, phone line, and office supplies.
My head spun as I realized the level of sleaziness I'd let myself slip to. Eyes closed, I said, "Let me get this straight. My job is to call these people at home, remind them of a contest entry they made months before, not to inform them that they've won, but that I'm now using that information to try to talk them into bringing their family to a motel room to have their picture taken by a total stranger? In a temporary studio that will disappear in a few days?"
"And push the clocks," Sandy reminded me. "We like to call them a memory that will last through time."
"Is there an actual cruise?" I asked, holding up a contest entry slip.
"Yes, the CEO takes one every year," Sandy said with a conspiratorial wink.
I looked around the room at the sadly desperate women, shuffling through their entry slips, joylessly logging their bookings on the progress charts. Each had a pleasant, cheerful voice and a face that looked like 10 miles of bad road. And they all seemed to be wearing tracksuits in various stages of shabbiness. Any time between calls was spent bent over their cubicles in a racking cough. Their endless streams of smoke had already stained the walls a lovely shade of nicotine gray. And if I wasn't mistaken, one of them appeared to be taking a sponge bath in the ladies' room with the door open. What had I gotten myself into? In terms of looking back at how your life went horribly awry, it was possible that accepting this job was worse than stumbling into vampirism. Waving at the tendrils of smoke curling around my head, I cast a sidelong glance at the little plaque on the wall that declared the office a smoke-free workplace. Sandy laughed and threaded an arm companionably through mine.
"I know. It's not really all that legal to let them smoke inside like this, but they just couldn't work without a smoke every once in a while. And the breaks would kill our productivity. So we just let them enjoy a nice cigarette while they work. It saves so much time, and everybody's happy."
"What about the non-smokers?" She smiled.
"You know, everybody who has come to work here eventually started smoking, so it's never come up."
Well, there was something to look forward to. At least I knew I couldn't get lung cancer. Sandy led me to an empty cubicle. The ladies on either side of me never broke their stride in their pitches to acknowledge my presence. Sandy didn't make any effort to introduce me, and I assumed that was intentional. Sandy strapped a freshly disinfected headset over my ears and handed me the script, a tip sheet titled "Never Take No for an Answer, How to Battle Common Excuses," and a green slip containing the name and phone number of Susan Greer of Portland, Oregon. Shouldn't I get some sort of training before I start making calls?
"Oh, there's no better training than jumping right in," she said. "And you're a quick study, I can tell. Just take a few seconds to go over your script and dial the number."
I stared at the script long enough to realize that the words weren't making any sense in my head. No matter how long I sat there reading this thing, I would never be able to translate it into a tempting sales pitch. With Sandy sitting at my side listening to every word, I dialed the number and prayed that Susan Greer wasn't home. No such luck. "Hello!" I shouted into the receiver when a female voice answered. "Is Susan Greer available?" This is Susan Greer, the woman said, a weary note of suspicion creeping into her voice.
My name is Jane. I'm calling this evening on behalf of Greenfield Studios. Our records show that you have indicated an interest in having your family portrait.
Not interested, Susan grumbled, and hung up.
I shot a guilty look at Sandy.
It happens all the time, she assured me. Just try again.
This time, I dialed Jamie Hurley of Portland, who was not much more receptive than Susan Greer.
Did you really interrupt my dinner to call me about this? She demanded.
I closed my eyes and tried to pick back up on a spot of the script I remembered. Our records show that you've indicated an interest in...
How did you even get my number, anyway? I'm supposed to be on a no-call list.
When I stopped reading the script, I had time to process exactly how small and guilty I felt calling this poor woman. I scanned the excuses list for, how did you get my number?
Well, you entered a contest to win a Caribbean cruise. I don't have time for this, she fumed. I can't believe you harass people at home like this. How do you live with yourself? How do losers like you even get jobs? If you call me again, I'm going to file harassment charges.
At the sound of the phone slamming in my ear, I turned to Sandy, my jaw slack. She patted my hand.
All right, honey. That wasn't a great call, but you get those sometimes. And it takes everyone a few calls to develop a rhythm. When someone is rude, the best thing to do is to take a deep breath and make another call.
So I made another call, and another. I was hung up on, had an air horn blown directly into my ear, and was called a bitch in three languages. Every time I dialed a number, I prayed the phone would ring unanswered. After 3 hours, when Chester Zimmerman of Piedmont, North Dakota, told me to commit unspeakable acts upon my own person with a cheese grater, I turned to Sandy, defeated. I don't think I'm comfortable with this.
And they can tell, honey, Sandy said, patting my hand again. You just need to relax your voice and speak in a more natural, confident tone.
I reached for my headset and realized I would rather attempt strangling myself with the phone cord than dial another number. I just don't think this is going to work for me. Sandy smiled, despite the tension pulling at the corners of her mouth.
Well, we have other sales divisions you can try.
I don't...
Oh, come on, Jane. Nobody likes a quitter. I want to find a place for you here.
She pulled me out of my seat and motioned for me to follow her to another door, where we found another smoke-filled cubicle farm.
Greenfield Studios is just one sales arm of Greenfield Enterprises. Our sales force also sells Revita Water, the new miracle cure that they don't want you to know about. Revita Water's scientifically calibrated balance of electrolytes and nutrients, plus a selection of health supplements and ephedra-free diet aids, will prevent almost any illness, from cancer to fibromyalgia to Lyme disease. But the main benefit is this amazing product's ability to reverse vampirism. Studies show that people who drink Revita Water as part of their daily health regimen will not turn if they're bitten. Just between you and me, police departments and emergency services are buying Revita Water in huge batches for protection when the vampires finally launch their anti-human campaign. It practically sells itself.
I stared at her. Apparently, Sandy had not yet noticed that I'd left the life status box blank on my application. But now I knew where the company policy stood on vampires. Beg pardon?
All right. So it doesn't actually cure vampirism, Sandy whispered. But there's nothing to prove that it won't help people get healthy enough to outrun the filthy bastards. You know, I never thought at my age I'd have to worry about being attacked by vicious, blood-sucking monsters in my own home. But that's the state of the world today. People are looking for protection, for assurance, and Greenfield Enterprises is here to fill that need.
Sandy wasn't saying anything in the way of anti-vampire ranting that I hadn't heard before. Heck, my grandmother had said worse over Christmas dinner. But I'd never heard it as a vampire, and I found it hurt more than I thought it would. Being in such a small, crowded room, I'd been keeping my mind clenched, for lack of a better word, to keep the other women's thoughts from bouncing around in my skull. But I imagined a little window in her head sliding open and was given a psychic slapping for my efforts. The fears and worries of every sad-eyed woman in the room came pouring into my head from all sides.
unpaid bills, cars with shoddy brakes, kids suspended from school, husbands who wouldn't get off the couch and earn a paycheck, the soul-sucking drudgery of having to show up for this job every night and not having any other choice. I shook the buzzing sensation out of my head and concentrated on Sandy. She may have hated vampires with a frantic and paranoid passion, but she sure liked me. She saw me doing well at Greenfield Enterprises. In fact, she saw me wearing the headset with pride, becoming a star employee, moving up in the ranks, and taking over the damned office so someone named Rico would finally let her retire. She had no idea I was a vampire. In fact, the thought never occurred to her. I'd never been part of any minority before, unless you counted those who thought Timothy Dalton made a decent James Bond, and I didn't particularly like people assuming that they could make rude comments about said minority because they thought I was safe. It was humiliating. And worse, it really pissed me off.
"Or, if you prefer something more tropical," Sandy said, reaching toward a door labeled Greenfield Coastal Timeshare Sales.
"Sandy, I'm going to have to stop you right there," I said. "I'm not going to be a good fit here. I'm sorry to have taken up your time. This has been a very enlightening experience. Please don't call me, ever."
"But we need a girl like you, Jane. You have the voice. With some practice, you could clear $100, $200 a night," she said. "We have girls quit without notice all the time because they can't stand the work or they just decide they don't want to come in that night. Someone like you isn't going to do that. You're one of those nice, responsible girls. You're going to show up on time and ready to work. You won't call 10 minutes before your shift and tell me you can't come in because you've been arrested. And you won't try to live in your van out in the parking lot. You'll serve as a good example to the other girls."
"So you need me to class up the joint?" I asked, my eyebrow arched. "That's new."
"Exactly," Sandy sighed.
"Thanks, but I'm still going to say no," I said, hustling toward the nearest fire exit. "After all, working here might interfere with my participation in the anti-human campaign." Sandy stared at me in bewilderment, so I flashed my fangs, rolled my eyes, and stalked out of the building. The words blood-sucking monsters and filthy bastards rang in my skull, and my cheeks burned as I stomped back to Big Bertha. I swore that if I found blood on her, I was going to go back to River Oaks, pack up, and move to Tibet. I had one of those out-of-body automatic driving experiences where I put the keys in the ignition, and the next thing I knew, I was turning Big Bertha around the corner to Gabriel's Road. I pulled into his driveway, climbed the stairs, and stared at the house. My hand froze in midair as I started to knock on his door. This was nothing new. I'd been to Gabriel's house before. Of course, I'd behaved like a screaming harridan when I was there before. And here I was, coming to his door with problems again. I chewed my lip and considered running back to my car. Then again, Gabriel was always going on about his responsibility and leading me through my vampire growing pains. Oh, let's be honest. I was there to get a few sympathy kisses, and maybe an elder vampire platitude or two. Something like, "It's always darkest before the dawn." And we never really see that, so why worry? Before I could knock, the door swung open and Gabriel was there.
"Jane,"
Gabriel exclaimed with a grin that faltered at the sight of my expression.
"What's wrong?"
I tilted my head and gave him a long, appraising look. "I know this is a long shot, but did you ever read a book called Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day?"
"No."
"But the title does lend itself to inference," Gabriel nodded. "Well, whatever you're inferring, add cigarette smoke and desperation."
"That explains the smell," he said, sniffing my hair. "Where have you been?"
"Working."
"You found a job?"
"That's as a telemarketer." He made the ouch face.
"Oh."
"For a company that sold, among other sleazy and dubious products, a vitamin tonic they claimed would reverse vampirism." Gabriel scoffed.
"Well, that's ridiculous. No one's ever been able to accomplish that."
"Not the point?"
"Sorry."
I agreed to sell this crap. Well, actually, I agreed to try to ensnare innocent families into booking appointments in questionable locations with complete strangers wielding cameras. But I was just terrible at it, because the customers could apparently smell my fear through the phone and just hung up on me, or they told me to drop dead, and we both know that horse is already out of the barn. It was hell, okay? I took a job in the stinkiest pit of minimum wage hell. Gabriel gave me a blank look.
Why didn't you ask more questions about the job before you took it?
I was just tired of not working. I wanted a job, any job, anything to make me feel useful and productive, and not doomed to move back in with my parents.
Jane, if it's a question of money, I could...
I touched a finger to his lips. Don't. Don't make an offer that will change our relationship. I appreciate the thought, but I'm not comfortable when you blur that daddy-boyfriend line.
The offer, which you wouldn't let me make, still stands.
Thank you. Anyway, when I could not lure people into these said appointments, my new boss told me all about the other stuff I could sell, including this anti-vampire snake oil. And then she told me that vampires are filthy, vicious creatures who are going to overthrow the human government in some bloody coup we've been planning for years.
I take it she didn't know you were a vampire, he said as I shook my head.
Not only was I subjected to the general abuse that telemarketers receive, and I now realize deserve just the tiniest bit, but I got treated to my very first hate speech.
Oh, you'll hear much worse over the years, he said, wrapping an arm around my shoulders and pressing me to his side. I once had a drunk in a tavern tell me a delightful joke about two vampires, a priest, and a...
I don't need to hear it, I assured him.
Also, I'm pretty sure this is one of those stories that ends in, and then I ate him.
Gabriel shrugged, but didn't deny it.
I laughed. You're laughing. That's always a good thing. Of course you're laughing at me, but I'm getting used to that, he said.
I leaned my forehead against his.
You really need to.
Gabriel pulled me onto his lap like a child woken by a nightmare.
Humans fear what they don't understand. And I don't believe that they will ever truly understand us. You will come across the stupid, the ignorant, the misinformed.
And I'm related to most of them, I said, leaning my head against his shoulder.
You will meet these people, and they will insult you. They may try to hurt you. You managed to escape the situation without lashing out or hurting anyone despite your anger. You did escape without hurting anyone, right?
Yes, I grumbled. I may have made a rude gesture or two behind a closed door, though.
See? You left with your dignity intact, which is far better than I would have done at your age. I'm proud of you.
Try not to take the things humans do so personally, Jane. You have to take the good with the bad.
And enjoy snacking on the bad?
Sometimes, yes. He chuckled, playing with the buttons of my sweater.
Can I offer you the use of my shower?
I rolled my eyes at him. That is the most abrupt pickup line I've ever heard. Gabriel's lips twisted into a half-smile, half-grimace, that somehow communicated that he wasn't just being playful and bantery.
"The smoke smell is that bad?" I cried. "I was only there for a few hours."
"It is pungent," he admitted.
"But my nose is much more sensitive than the average man's. And to make up for this insult, I will take you upstairs and wash you from head to toe."
"Will there be bubbles?" I asked.
"Bubbles can be arranged."
He nodded solemnly, parting the buttons to toy with the Chinese finger trap that was my front enclosure bra. Gabriel peeled away my sweater. I was enjoying the novelty of being both topless and outdoors when an expression of revulsion skittered across his features. I looked down, checking my torso for any sort of disfiguring scars or moles I may have missed in the last 2 decades.
What?
It's actually worse now, he said, his nose wrinkling. I choked out a shocked laugh.
Nice.
I can work around it, he promised quickly, realizing he'd hurt my feelings.
I don't need to breathe.
Thank you for your commitment to the task at hand. Gabriel went back to work with a determined air, stroking my skin as he pressed kisses along my throat. I tipped my head back. My bones seemed to become liquid as he rubbed slow circles over my spine. I looked down and saw him hesitating as he pressed his lips to my skin, as if the contact would sting. He was forcing himself to continue his path from my throat to my collarbone.
You really shouldn't have to try this hard, I told him, pushing his hair back from his face.
But it's very sweet.
I'm sorry. It seems to have taken up residence in your pores, Gabriel said kindly.
This is not the night to do this. Stinky is definitely not the note I want to start out on, I said, sniffing my once lucky, now destined for burning sweater. I'm going home and bathing in tomato juice. It worked when Fitz used the skunk as a chew toy last summer.
Stay a few moments, he said, stroking my knees as I slipped the sweater back on. I think I can tolerate your aromatic presence a while longer.
Gee, thanks, I muttered. He kissed me softly, tracing the line of my mouth with his tongue before withdrawing and doing his best to hide his instinct to recoil. It was a valiant attempt, I told him.
It's rather like licking an ashtray, he said apologetically. You don't breathe. How did you get that much secondhand smoke in your mouth?
I talked constantly for 3 hours.
Tell me again why this job didn't suit you, he asked, making an undignified oof sound when I poked his stomach. I'm sorry you had a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Still, knowing you, you'll turn it into some sort of learning experience.
Yes, I've learned I'm going to be a lot nicer to telemarketers from now on. I sniffed as I snuggled into his chest.
See? There's a silver lining after all.
We sat in silence and listened to frogs chirping on his front lawn. Gabriel was slowly but surely leaning his head away from me. After a minute or so, his face was as far away from me as his neck would allow.
All right, all right, I grumbled, getting to my feet. I'll go home and shower. I'm sorry, he assured me as he followed me to my car. Otherwise, I find you irresistible.
I glared at him half-heartedly as he leaned in for a kiss. Thinking twice when he was hit with my aura of nicotine, he reached out and shook my hand. I laughed.
You're laughing. That's always a good sign, he said again as I climbed into Big Bertha.
I kept laughing until I stopped at the end of Gabriel's road. I looked into the rearview mirror and saw a girl with a glint in her eye and a goofy grin on her face.
Oh, Jane, you've got it bad.
Chapter 14. Vampires can be territorial and possessive creatures. While it makes them passionate and exciting lovers, it can also make them terrifying ex-lovers. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. You know how people complain that Christmas has become too crass and commercial? Well, boo-hoo. Have you seen what humans have done to Halloween? It's all excuse to dress slutty witch costumes, chainsaw serial killer movie marathons, and life-size electric dancing mummies. And let's not even talk about how culturally insensitive the whole dang holiday is toward the undead. How would humans feel if we put inflatable versions of them on our lawns? I didn't take this all so personally until my first undead Halloween. Believe it or not, vampires tend to hole up on All Hallows' Eve and refuse to come out until the last candy corn has been consumed. Part of it is the commercial resentment, but mostly it's the hope to avoid a bunch of drunk idiots doing their worst Transylvanian accent. While explaining the various holiday pitfalls, Gabriel said he usually spent Halloween watching old movies, an incurable Hitchcock fan. And then he invited himself over to my house. This may sound juvenile, but I was nervous. Then again, our first date involved me being interrogated, so I didn't feel this was unwarranted. We were going to have the place to ourselves. Aunt Jetty had a date to go out with Grandpa Fred, walking the earth when the veil between the spirit world and reality was at its thinnest and all that. It had taken some work, but I'd finally exercised the offensive Ode to Marlboro Man scent that clung to my skin for days after I left Greenfield Studios. I bathed in tomato juice, used 4 different types of clarifying shampoo, and invested in the economy pack of Listerine. I also took more care with my appearance than usual that night. I wore a gauzy green blouse and my good jeans. I'd actually bothered with earrings, a rare thing for me. And I was wearing makeup. Yes, I did own makeup, blush and powder and chapstick, but not eyeliner. There was an incident in college. I had to wear an eye patch for 2 weeks. I wanted my sire to see that when I wasn't drunk or freaking out, I wasn't a total gorgon. And I even wore cute black underwear, because you never knew. The only real problem was entertainment. I didn't think building an evening around, "Come over and make out with me," was a good way to start a relationship. Then again, "Come over and play canasta," is just lame. My DVD collection did not include the old-fashioned thrillers Gabriel liked, but rather an alarming number of romantic comedies that I didn't want Gabriel to know I had seen, much less owned. and I never realized what a minefield Halloween television could be. Imagine my horror to find the channels crowded with the Blade trilogy and the Lost Boys. In terms of entertainment value, Lost Boys is a great movie, but it involved the unholy trinity that is Corey Feldman, Corey Haim, and Joel Schumacher, and therefore I cannot claim it as a suitable model for my lifestyle. We finally settled on Francis Ford Coppola's version of Dracula, which, unfortunately, Gabriel seemed to think was a comedy. I think it was the combination of Keanu Reeves's British accent and Gary Oldman's elderly Count Dracula hairstyle. They're just misleading. "Why would he arrange his hair into buttocks on top of his head?" Gabriel laughed. "You're not the first person to ask that," I told him. He was just so darn cute when he laughed. The skin around his eyes crinkled, his face relaxed. It made him seem so alive, so normal, which in itself seemed weird. "I never realized how funny Dracula could be," he said. "Most vampires resent Stoker for the public relations nightmare he visited on us all, but we secretly enjoy the story. It was the first time vampires were portrayed as sensual creatures, as opposed to mindless, reeking ghouls." You know what book talk does to me," I growled, stopping when I noticed how prim he looked, sitting in the exact center of my sofa with his back ramrod straight. He was sitting almost a foot away from me, with his hands at his sides. "Why are you sitting like that?" "I know you have a problem with this on occasion, but I was talking just then." "Seriously, why are you sitting like that?" I asked, ignoring his grimace at being interrupted again. "Because the furniture designers didn't intend for us to sit on the back of the sofa," he suggested. "You are blatantly violating the rules of the couch date," I said.
"Couch date?"
"When you spend an entire evening on the couch with an attractive person of the opposite sex, it's called a couch date," I said.
"I've never been on a couch date," he admitted.
"Well, let me introduce you to the protocol." I nudged him into the corner and laid his arm across the back of the sofa. "You sit here, I sit here. As the movie progresses, I will lean closer and closer. Eventually, I will be in this position." I curled against his side with my head leaned against his shoulder. "You can use this to your advantage."
"How?"
he asked, clearly intrigued. "You'll figure it out," I said, bringing his arm around me. "Did you know there are at least 19 different types of kissing? Open-mouthed and soft kisses that make your toes curl, tiny, dry kisses peppering your jaw, tongue, no tongue. And Gabriel knew all of them. Sometimes it paid to date a really old guy. He had a lot of experience. And the best part was that I didn't have a thought in my head the entire time. Okay, yeah, I did, but most of them were along the lines of, oh, and thank God I wore the black panties."
"Is this a violation of couch date protocol?"
he asked when I opened my eyes, half dazed.
"No, this is in fact exactly in keeping with couch date protocol," I murmured.
"I'm so glad," he said, toying with the hem of my blouse before dragging it over my head and tossing it into a pile on the other side of the couch. I enjoyed the skim of his hands against my bare arms, my stomach against his chest as I slid into his lap. He bent his head to run his lips along the contours of my ribs, flexing his fingers around my hips when it made me jump. His hands slid up my back, dragging me down to meet his mouth. He glided his fingers across my belly, brushing them over my aforementioned panties and the little strawberry-shaped damp spot I'd left on them. I jumped again, forcing his hand harder against me in a way that wasn't entirely unpleasant. I made a breathy little noise that had Gabriel grinning. His clever hand rubbed slow circles over the fabric. I felt his mouth close over my nipple, through the lace of my bra as he pushed the fabric aside. And then the doorbell rang.
"Seriously?"
I gasped as Gabriel bit gently at the place where my neck and shoulder joined.
"Ignore it,"
Gabriel whispered. He undid my bra completely and tossed it across the room.
"Please."
I nodded in mute agreement as my mouth closed over his again. I was fully prepared to ignore anything less than an alien invasion on the front lawn when the bell gave three more quick peals. Apparently, whoever it was refused to go away, which would have been the reasonable response of any reasonable person harassing a girl who hadn't had sex in 3 years.
Whoever it is, I'm going to kill them, I vowed as the doorbell chimed again.
What if it's trick-or-treaters?
He asked as I disentangled myself and straightened my clothes. Anyone over 5 feet tall is fair game, I conceded as I struggled into my blouse. Where is my bra?
Gabriel looked around the room and shrugged.
Well, whoever it is will have to deal with free-swinging Jane, I said, and let that be a lesson to them. I opened the door to find Jack and Rose from Titanic standing on my porch. Or at least, Zeb and Jolene dressed as Jack and Rose in their jump scene clothes. Because I needed Gabriel to meet Jolene while she was wearing a gorgeous Edwardian rental gown. I wouldn't pale by comparison or anything. What are you guys doing here? I asked, my tone not exactly welcoming.
Well, we just finished up at a costume party and we thought you might not have plans tonight, he said.
Zeb, honey, I think she has somebody here, Jolene said, pulling him back as she took in my tousled hair, the general state of me.
I would have blushed if I still had circulation. Even I could smell the coppery scent of arousal in the room, and with Jolene's senses... At that moment, Jolene motioned down to my shirt, which was inside out. I groaned. With my vampire senses and agility, you'd think putting on a blouse wouldn't be that difficult.
Yeah. I looked back toward my parlor. I really hoped Gabriel still had pants on, because otherwise, this could be awkward. Actually, there is someone here, whom I want you to meet, in a way that you remember.
Okay. That's not cryptic,
Zeb said, hauling a duffel bag and some carry-out sacks from Smoky Bones Barbecue into the house. You are going to change clothes before you eat the barbecue, right? If not, she can kiss that costume deposit goodbye, I asked. I'd seen Jolene around ribs.
I heard that,
Jolene called as she went into the kitchen to search for plates. Sensing that semi-naked happy fun time was over, Gabriel, pants intact, came out of the parlor just as Jolene came back in to claim her share of the ribs.
Hi, I'm Jolene. It's real nice to meet you.
Jolene crossed to him and shook his hand.
Gabriel Nightingale, he said, tapping his teeth. McLean Clan?
Very good, she said, grinning. Not a lot of people pick up on canine patterns.
Behavior patterns? I asked.
No, the actual pattern of her canine teeth, Gabriel said. Werewolves have strong and specific genetic markers, even for something as simple as dental configuration. Different clans have different bite patterns. Jolene has the classic McLean arrangement, a slight overbite with nicely spaced bottom incisors.
You know an alarming amount of information about regional teeth, I told him. Jolene giggled, a sound that was followed by a long conversational pause.
Well, Zeb rubbed his hands together. This is really awkward.
Zeb and Jolene busied themselves with unwrapping enough barbecued ribs, potato salad, and coleslaw to feed about 10 people.
So much food.
Gabriel marveled at my coffee table, groaning under the weight of the spread.
You know we don't eat, right? I asked.
Jolene laughed, a throaty sound that was equal parts growl and giggle. She wiped a smear of sauce from her chin.
Oh, this is just a snack.
She rolled her eyes.
I'll probably have to eat a pork shoulder or something before bed.
On our first date, she ate a whole lasagna and still had room for tiramisu. Who's my bottomless pit? Who's my little bottomless pit?
Zeb said proudly, snuffling behind Jolene's ears.
Down, boy,
Jolene giggled.
We didn't forget about y'all, though. We brought bottled blood, and we got wine. It's strawberry.
She held up an obscenely red bottle with dancing berries on the label. Gabriel shuddered, an imperceptible movement caught only by my vampire eyes.
I don't drink wine.
I shot a look at Gabriel. I hoped he could see me thinking, I know you stole that line from Dracula. Undeterred, Jolene offered the bottle to me.
Jane?
No, thanks. Handing Gabriel and me each a warmed bottle of an imported upmarket synthetic blood called Sangre, Zeb gave me a sly look.
Jane never drinks anyway. Not since the incident her sophomore year.
Zeb, I growled.
Having seen Jane drink, I think I'd like to hear this story, Gabriel said, cheerfully passing the wine to Zeb.
Like I'm the only person who's ever vomited while drunk, I grumbled. Zeb grinned.
You are the only person I know who's done it on an occupied police car.
I glared at him. If you want to start trading stories, we can start trading stories. As a former member of the Richard Marks fan club, you don't want to start this arms race.
Zeb smiled meekly around a rib.
Agreed.
Richard Marks? Jolene asked. He went through an obnoxiously tearful pop phase.
Don't ask.
Over the course of the evening, I saw again how besotted Jolene was with Zeb, and vice versa. He hung on every word that spilled from her perfect pout. If they would just have stopped smooching and slobbering all over each other, I could have stood being in the same county with them. As predicted, Jolene and Zeb plowed through the food. I used Aunt Jetty's favorite glasses to serve the wine and a delicious dessert version of Synthetic Blood, Cafe Transylvania by General Foods International Coffees. There was that awkward moment when everyone runs out of food and drink to occupy themselves, and we were all left looking at each other with nothing to say. Well, Jolene was still engrossed in her barbecue, but Zeb, Gabriel, and I were at a weird conversational impasse. Fortunately, Gabriel had a full century's worth of experience with uncomfortable social situations, so he was able to break the ice.
Zeb, Jane says you're a kindergarten teacher.
Yup,
Zeb said, bracing for the inevitable, isn't babysitting a bunch of kids sort of a weird job for a grown man, questions that inevitably followed. Since entering the classroom, Zeb had found that male teachers were welcome at the high school level, but that men who wanted to spend their time with small children were immediately suspected of being lazy or creepy.
I admire people who can work with small children, Gabriel said. I have always found them to be unsettling little creatures.
Zeb grinned.
Well, they are, but I'd rather spend time with them than most of their parents. Yesterday, I had a mother try to tell me that her son shoving another kid off the top of the jungle gym was a form of creative expression. And then she launched into a lecture on why I should only serve gluten-free carob cookies for snack time. Between the helicopter parents and the parents who drop their kids off without a word except to tell me that their kids are my problem now, I will take nose-picking and toy-grabbing any time. Also, I just really like taking a nap after lunch every day.
Gabriel chuckled and poured Zeb another glass of wine.
So, Gabriel, Jane says you saved her life with this whole vampire thing, Zeb said. I appreciate that. She's been my best friend since we were kids, and I'm glad she didn't die in a deer hunting mishap. For me to win the pool, her death had to involve a tragic water skiing accident.
Touching, Zeb, I muttered.
But Jane also said you played Shake the Etch-a-Sketch with my memory. I would prefer you not do that again. Even if you think I can't handle some part of your world, let me decide whether I want to remember it or not.
Same goes,
Jolene said, raising her hand, her voice muffled by a rib.
Hey, Jane, Zeb told me about the telemarketing thing.
I tamped down the urge to be annoyed with Zeb for sharing my humiliation with his girlfriend. Of course he told Jolene about my disastrous one-night stand with phone sales. I needed to accept that my life was now there, and how was your day, fodder?
Don't feel bad, Jolene told me. My Uncle Lonnie gave me a job in his bait shop one summer, and I let a whole cooler's worth of crickets loose. One of the customers started screaming that it was a biblical plague and started having chest pains. We had to call 911. For the rest of the summer, all my cousins called me Cricket, and Uncle Lonnie sent me to work at the sandwich shop. It was a much better fit for me. That's all you have to do, Jane. Just find your fit.
Or I can follow your lead and unleash a plague of locusts like this town has never seen, I said, rubbing my chin with an evil genius glare. Jolene snorted, clapping her hand over her mouth to keep from spewing potato salad over my coffee table.
No more jokes while I'm chewing.
The good news was that Jolene and Zeb really seemed to like spending time with me and Gabriel. The bad news is that meant they stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed. Gabriel and I were cuddled under a throw at one corner of the couch, barely able to cover that we were desperately trying to touch each other without being noticed. We watched the rest of Dracula, moved on to From Dusk Till Dawn, and resorted to Fright Night before Gabriel finally gave up and decided to take his leave for the evening. I walked him out as Jolene popped her fourth bag of Super Butter Lovers popcorn in my microwave.
I think they've moved in with you and just haven't told you, Gabriel whispered as I closed the door behind us.
He clutched my face in his hands and seized my mouth in a fierce kiss.
What are they trying to do to us?
I don't know, I giggled as Gabriel pulled me with him on his trek to the car. Zeb is usually much better at taking hints, but I think he's doing some sort of weird brotherly protection thing. It's either very sweet or just this side of cruel and unusual.
Did I just pass some sort of test?
He asked.
The test to determine whether your friends think I'm good enough for you?
Test, I sputtered, giving a raspberry laugh. That's just crazy talk. There was no... Yes. Yes, you did. I wasn't intentionally testing you, but you did beautifully. Jolene was eating out of the palm of your suave and charming hand. Zeb obviously both fears and admires you. But you did turn his best friend into a vampire. He still rants about a guy who borrowed my iPod after a second date and didn't return it. It could take some time for him to adjust to us double dating.
I like Zeb, Gabriel said. He's odd.
That he is.
He suits you, and he loves you, that much is obvious. You're very lucky to have such a friend.
That's very progressive of you. Some guys are uncomfortable with the whole male best friend thing.
Well, if I thought he had romantic designs on you, I would have to make him forget he ever met you and give him a sudden urge to relocate to Guadalajara,
he said solemnly. Aw, that's so sweet, I chuckled, kissing him. You know, this counts as our third date since you made your I'll-know-when-you're-ready-for-sex declaration. In human terms, that's very significant.
Third date?
Yeah, there was an actual meal served while we were at Cracker Barrel, so I'm counting it. And the smoke-filled porch coziness. And then tonight. In human dating terms, that's three, which is like a sexual green light. So, next time, yes?
If the universe was fair, we would have finished what we started on the couch, he agreed. Next time.
I gave him one more smacking kiss before he started his car. And if Zeb shows up, he's bound for Guadalajara.
Agreed.
Chapter 15. When you encounter unpleasantness from the human population, try to keep in mind that you will be able to dance on their graves long after they're dead. It's a cheering thought. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. As I headed toward my 3-month undead anniversary, I got twitchy. Not espresso marathon twitchy, but certainly not the sort of person you'd want to get stuck in an elevator with. My nerves were crawling under my skin. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't find anything I wanted to drink, but I still drank every drop of fake blood in the house, which I was sure would go straight to my thighs. It took 2 episodes of an intervention marathon for me to realize I was going through book withdrawal. I hadn't purchased a new one in more than a month, and I hadn't checked anything out of the library since the morning before I was fired, which also meant I had 4 books that were long overdue. I had late fines. I had never had late fines in my entire life. I had to go to the library, right? It was closing in an hour, and there couldn't be that many people there this late on a weeknight. Plus, I needed more information about wolves' mating habits and the probability of accidental friend mauling. I'd done some research online, but I didn't know how reliable it was. According to werewolvesdebunked.com, werewolves manage to pass as humans, but they are far more in touch with their natural instincts than most humanoid creatures. It can mean a certain earthy, rugged appeal for the werewolf males who manage to hold on to all their teeth, but it also means they're impulsive, temperamental, fiercely territorial, and not a whole lot of fun 1 week a month. They had my sympathy on that count. Werewolf metabolism is so high that they have to scarf down calories all day just to sleep all night, like a mini hibernation. Thanksgiving in a werewolf clan is like a full-on farm animal massacre. Multiple turkeys, hams, chickens, sides of beef, legs of venison, and then they fight over the bones in the weirdest touch football game ever. But constantly thinking and talking about food is what makes werewolves some of the best chefs in the world. Think about it. Have you ever seen Emeril Lagasse during a full moon? Contrary to popular myth, werewolves are born, not made. No matter how many times they bite someone, that person will not turn, though they will probably bleed profusely and will definitely be annoyed. Also, were-creatures can change day or night no matter what phase of the moon. But their change is less controlled, more complete, during the full moon. Personally, I thought they used it as an excuse. Oh, I can't remember eating your chickens and peeing on your couch. I was wolfed out last night. Werewolves are pack animals, led by a patriarchal alpha male. A pack generally lives in close quarters, filling an apartment complex, a subdivision, or a gated community in more affluent clans. In southern packs, it usually means parking a number of trailers and houses on a farm. This fits nicely into the redneck stereotype of big, dysfunctional, overly close families. After the chaos of the coming out, werewolves were sure that vampires had doomed themselves to extinction. Since many werewolves consider vampires to be stuck-up, pretentious snobs, they didn't consider it a great loss. Most were-creatures watched with interest as vampires integrated into human society, but few were ready to come out into the open. Werewolves share their secrets with a few select, trusted humans. Those who betray werewolf clans? Well, I don't know what happens to them, because they're never heard from again. While this information was a good start, it didn't do much to convince me of Zeb's safety. On top of my research problems, I needed Mrs. Stubblefield's signature to file for undead unemployment benefits, a service for new vampires. The 2000 census showed that 29% of newly turned vampires lost their jobs during the unexplained 3-day absence while they waited to rise. New vampires who lost their jobs could file for council-funded benefits for up to 6 months. Fortunately, you didn't have to prove that losing your job was a result of being turned. And since people expected me actually to pay for my synthetic blood, I was going to need all the help I could get. Besides, I had to face the library sometime, right? Well, I couldn't. I got as far as the book drop in the parking lot and had a crisis of spine. I pictured having to make eye contact with my former co-workers, checking books out from the public side of the desk, looking Mrs. Stubblefield in the eye, and watching Posey incorrectly shelve books. I just couldn't do it. So I shoved the books into the drop and ran away like a girl. It took me a few blocks before I realized I'd forgotten my car, which was becoming a bit of a habit. I slowed on a seedier section of Main Street, with its big, decaying brick structures from the town's boom days. My parents never ventured through this part of town when I was growing up, and my mother offered dire warnings of what might happen if I did. And now that I was walking down the dark, weed-choked street, I could see why. I passed several pawn shops, liquor stores, a shop with a cardboard sign over the windows that simply said, "Videos." And on the corner, I noticed a little blue sign that read, "Specialty Books," in peeling gold paint. Half Moon Hollow's literary outlets were limited to an ailing Walden Books and the library. How could there be a bookstore in this town that I was unaware of? Of course, this place didn't look as if it was a member of the local Chamber of Commerce. Sure that I was about to enter a cleverly disguised adult bookstore, I pushed the door open. An old cowbell tinkled above the door as I walked in. It was an Ali Baba's cave of literary treasures, their cracked spines winking out at my superhuman eyes through the incredibly bad lighting. I loved old books as much as the next bibliophile, but these were crumbling, suffering. I wandered the shelves, running my fingers over the spines. The shop offered everything from 16th-century manuscripts hand-copied by monks to old Tales from the Crypt comics, but finding either on purpose would be a small miracle. Hanks of herbs hanging from the ceiling, candles of all colors and shapes, and scattered crystal geodes only added to the air of committed disorganization. There was no effort to let the customer know what subjects were located where. Plus, there didn't appear to be a division of subjects anyway. Books on astral projection were mixed in with books on herb gardening. Books on post-death tax issues were mixed in with guides on the proper care and feeding of Yeti. I picked up an orange, soft-covered book titled The Idiot's Guide to Vampirism. "It's official. Vampires are now uncool," I muttered to no one, as there didn't appear to be anyone else in the building. I shuffled through the books. There were some useful selections, but it took a keen eye to find them. Werewolves, a vampire's best friend or foe? A compendium of self-defense spells. From fangs to fairy folk, unusual creatures of Midwestern North America. 50 ways to add variety to your undead diet. Living with the dead. How to happily occupy a haunted house. And perhaps the most bizarre title, Tuesdays with Maury. I was so engrossed in my task I didn't detect the presence over my shoulder that asked,
"Oh, hello. What are you doing?"
I turned to see a skinny old man, wizened to the point of cuteness. He was dressed in a gray cardigan with skipped buttons and brown corduroy pants held up with a black leather belt and bright red suspenders. There was a Mont Blanc pen stuck behind his ear, practically lost in the frizzled gray nest of hair. A pair of bifocals, repaired with white tape and a paperclip, sat perched on his balding crown. I looked down and saw I was balancing stacks of books in my hands. I hadn't even realized that I'd spent about a half hour sorting the books by fiction, nonfiction, author, then subject. It was as if I were in some sort of alphabetically induced trance. I dropped the books to the floor. "I'm so sorry. I'm a complete freak. I used to work at the library, and it just drives me crazy to see books so out of order."
"It's a pretty habit. There are more shelves in the back, you know."
He grinned. Following Gabriel's advice, I cast out my senses, feeling for anything out of the ordinary. There was nothing. He was 100% human, just a funny old man who loved weird stuff. "I must be the rudest customer you've ever had," I moaned, shelving the books. He chuckled.
"Nope. That would be Edwina Myers, a horrible woman who tries to close me down every few years. Claims I'm a bad influence. Though whom I'm influencing, I have no idea."
He nodded to the empty store. "I've lived in the Hollow for my whole life. How did I not know about this place?" I asked.
"Well, I don't advertise in the Yellow Pages, and there's a limited interest in occult books in the Hollow. We don't have a walk-in business. I like to think of the store as one of those mystical places you pass right by unless you already know it's there."
"But I found it."
"Yes, you did. Gilbert Wainwright, by the way," he said, extending his hand.
"Jane Jameson." I reached out to shake it, then shrieked as my fingers brushed the silver band he wore around his middle finger. I yowled, and my fangs extended. A defense mechanism, I suppose, kind of like cursing when you touch a hot iron. I drew back my hand and watched the dirty gray streak across my palm fade away.
"How interesting," he said,
his voice tinged with awe as he stared at his ring.
"It's still thrilling to meet one of your kind, you know. The great coming out was a dream come true for me. As a boy, I used to pretend I was a vampire hunter on a mission to kill Dracula. Or I would pretend I was the vampire stalking the foggy streets of London for a tasty lady of ill repute."
"You must have had a very interesting childhood," I said, suppressing a smirk. I don't think he heard me because he continued.
"It came as absolutely no surprise to me that vampires lived among us, so to speak. I've devoted my entire life to studying the paranormal. Ghosts, demons, the living dead, the undead, were-creatures. I've always found it all fascinating. But still, it gives me a zing whenever I see that."
He nodded at my healing palm.
"Gave me a zing, too,"
I said, my fangs snagging my lip when I smiled. He took a moment to get the joke and laughed uproariously.
"Yes, yes, in the future, I suppose it would be more polite to offer vampires my left hand."
"Or you could take the ring off," I suggested.
"Oh, no,"
he said, absently stroking the worn band.
"I never take it off."
"Okay, then. Not cryptic at all." I chuckled. "You have an interesting selection here, Mr. Wainwright. How much of this was added after the coming out?" He gave me a curious look. "You had books on vampire diets and after-death tax issues before you knew for sure that we existed?" I asked. He nodded. "Do you have any books on ancient vampire laws? Because I'm pretty sure I'm getting hosed on a murder rap."
"Actually, no. But I can probably find something if you give me a few days,"
Mr. Wainwright said, apparently unimpressed by my mentioning the murder thing. This made me wonder about his clientele.
"So much of my business is handled online now. I just don't have time to keep things up here at the store."
"You sell online?"
80% of my sales are online. My website registers 50,000 hits per month.
A smirk lifted the wrinkles at his mouth.
Loyal customers and eBay are enough to keep me going. Just last week, I sent 3 volumes on weremonkeys to Sri Lanka.
Weremonkeys? I repeated, unsure if he was joking. Obviously upset by my lack of familiarity with weremonkeys, Mr. Wainwright gave me a copy of A Geographical Study of Were Creatures. He explained that he became familiar with the more exotic wares while he served in World War II. After that, he continued to pursue his interests abroad. There are some things you just can't study in the Hollow. He returned home 30 years earlier to tend his ailing mother, who had died only the previous year. I scanned the shop. It had so much potential. And now, with the emerging vampire population, there was an emerging market. And I'd be able to work around books again. The schedule would be flexible. The boss seemed to understand, nay, embrace, my special needs. Sure, there wouldn't be a lot of kids in an occult bookshop, but you can't ask for everything. I don't suppose you'd be looking for a shop assistant, would you? I asked. I could box and ship orders, do some shelving, maybe a little light cleaning. I could start off part-time, night hours, obviously, on a trial basis to see whether it works out. Mr. Wainwright chewed his lip thoughtfully and patted his pockets. It looked as if he was searching for his glasses, which were perched on top of his head. I plucked them from his crown and pressed them gently into his hands. He smiled. I've worked in the public library for 6 years. I have a master's in library science. I have experience helping people finding the right books for their needs.
It sounds like you might be overqualified, dear.
I'm not, really. I just want to work around books again. At the rear of the store, a bookcase collapsed, sending several leather-bound books skittering across the floor. He lifted a scraggly white eyebrow.
"Perhaps you could start off with some reorganization," he said, looking at the neat stacks of books I'd arranged around us. "You seem to have a steady hand at that."
I had learned my lesson from Greenfield Studios, so we sat down to discuss schedules, pay scale, distribution of responsibilities, and the fact that at some point he was going to want to see a copy of my resume. I left